Hello, I'm Mariëtte Snyman. Welcome to Calm, Clear and Helpful, a weekly podcast series on taking good care of yourself and others, introducing you to a wide range of wellness professionals ready to inform and inspire. Today's topic is Navigating Prostate Cancer, What I've Learned. My guest is Elred Lawrence, traveler, adventurer, and foodie from Cape Town. Welcome, Elred.
Thank you very much indeed. It's nice to be here.
To our listeners, please forgive me if I sound a bit hoarse. It's that time of the year. And after our conversation, Elred will give us his three tips on living a good life. Then it will be fun question time.
I'm looking forward to that.
Elred, could you give us a bird's eye view of your career?
Oh, yeah, thank you. So I started my working career in the Merchant Navy. I worked for SAF Marine. I was a radio and electronics officer on board all the big cargo ships and container ships and fruit ships for 8 years. It was fascinating. And from that early time in my life, from 21 to 29, I got my passion for traveling. That's where the travel bug bit me. After I left the sea, I joined companies and worked in IT consistently. I'd studied electronics, so it was very easy to get into IT in the early 80s. And I worked in manufacturing and in retail for the next 35 years, doing a variety of work in various IT systems and IS systems. Ever since I retired, I've been fortunate to have been employed in a number of companies running IT projects for them. And that was really, really good because it meant I was busy and active and social and I had money coming in. Subsequently, because of the economy and a variety of things, and I suspect old age is one of them, the number of jobs has dwindled to nothing. So I've had to go out and look for other work, something else to keep me happy and busy and active and engaged. So now I have joined a company where I'm a wealth engineer. That's my title. So I help others to earn a sustainable and residual income. And this is so important in South Africa because we find that the amount of jobs and people jobless and the potential for the amount of months to be left at the end of your money is huge. And so I find great satisfaction in working with people and we work together to make sure that we have a sustainable income for the future and as a legacy for the children.
That's very interesting. And I also happen to know that you have a Bobby McGee in your life. Would you like to tell us?
Yes, I always, Mariëtte, you know that once you get me started, this pod could be a very long podcast. Me and Bobby McGee. Bobby's my bicycle. Bobby and I travel around the world. I'm a solo cycle tourist. And it started, incidentally, in 2002 when I was reading a Getaway magazine. And the last article in the Getaway magazine was on the walking, the Camino de Santiago. And I read the article and I thought, that's crazy. I don't have 45 days to go and spend walking a Camino. I just wish I could cycle it. And the very, very last sentence of that article said, and you can cycle it. So I said, well, that's it. I'm going cycling. At that time, I only had a mountain bike, but I kitted it out and took it to Spain. And I cycled from the Pyrenees, Roncesvalles Baez to Santiago. And that was the beginning of my passion for cycling. So then I went, waited a few years, and I found there is another Camino, another pilgrim trail called the Via Francigena, which goes from Canterbury Cathedral in England to the Vatican in Rome. And that's 6 weeks long. So I packed up my bicycle again, and I went and cycled that, and it was just the most unbelievable experience, getting better and better as I gained more confidence, more experience, more understanding of the joy that just being in nature can bring you. And then I bought Bobby. She's a beautiful yellow touring bike, and eventually we set off to cycle from Singapore to Hong Kong together. It's an 8-country trip that took 8 months and 12,000 kilometers, and we had an absolute blast. And then at the end of 2022, I managed to go and cycle in Bali and Java and Thailand again. So that's my joy of life. That's my passion. Bobby and I are the very, very best friends. And everybody who knows me knows Bobby and always asks, how's Bobby? They know she's more than just a bicycle.
Mm. Oh, that's the way to live life. Could you tell us what are your core values?
That's the most fascinating question. I saw this in your prelim, and I was quite astounded because I said to myself, at my age of 72, I've never actually sat down and written them down. You always live from some sort of instinct of how you want to frame your life and how you want to be. So it was a really interesting exercise for me, and I came up with a number, but I chose the ones that mean the very, very most to me. So I think not necessarily any order this is, but it's the way I put them down. Respect. I think respect is so important. Treating others with kindness and empathy and dignity, especially in this turmoil of the world that we live in, is very, very important. And allied to that is compassion. Showing care and concern for others, engaging in acts of kindness and generosity, and just being there when people need you. I know that throughout my life, I've had to face a number of challenges, and we're talking about one of them today. So I think courage is really, really important to me, facing challenges and fears with a level of confidence and at least a brave face. And if you know me, you'll know that I always talk about gratitude. I wake up in the morning and I have a moment of gratitude. I'm awake, I'm breathing, the sun is shining. I go down to the beach every morning and I swim. And as I'm swimming, I'm grateful to have a beautiful sea and a place where I can swim for free. And it's just joyous. So gratitude is important, appreciating people, opportunities, experiences in your life. I feel the same when I'm cycling, as you cycle through a forest or nature, and you hear the birds and you hear the rustling of animals, and you just feel absolutely grateful for the life that you have. And then above and beyond, I think it's really important, and this just takes us in a circle back to respect and compassion, is creating meaningful relationships, being honest and open about who I am, and then creating relationships of trust. I think that's really important. And I have a vast circle of friends that I'm fortunate to have met when I travel, and I'm really blessed and very grateful for that.
Thank you, Elred. And the reason I asked you is today's topic, which is prostate cancer. Because when you and I spoke before we recorded the podcast, we spoke about how one's attitude to life would influence your attitude to great big challenges like this one. And you have overcome prostate cancer. Could we start at the beginning when you received the diagnosis, or even before that?
Thank you for the opportunity to share my experiences and my thoughts and feelings. It's another very interesting part of this podcast, and that I've never really just sat down and encapsulated them. So I'm grateful to have this opportunity. Essentially, I go for a 6-month medical checkup regularly. Well, regularly, every 6 months, I guess. And one of those checkups, as you get older, is always a prostate examination. And it's a very uncomfortable examination, both for the patient and the doctor, I suspect. But it's what you put up with, because it's one of the things that you need to know. And the examination at some point in time, the doctor said he's a little bit worried. The prostate is slightly enlarged, and he would like to take this further. So we started doing regular blood tests every 3 months, taking a PSA test. PSA, by the way, stands for prostate-specific antigen test. You've always got antigens in your prostate, but if you start to get prostate cancer, then those antigens increase. And that's the one way that it's sort of pain-free to monitor your prostate cancer progress. And the doctor told me at the beginning that it's a very, very, very slow growing cancer, that you don't need to worry. I was already, I'm 72 now, I guess about 58. So he said there's a good chance that you will live with it rather than die from it. So that was a little bit of comfort. And because of the regular PSA tests, and it was changing, but marginally. In the beginning, I was quite comfortable. I had no real issues. It was just, it's not painful. It's not impacts your life in any way. So I just carried on with life. But then we came to a point where the PSA readings were starting to go up quite quickly, and the doctors became concerned. So that's when I started saying, well, maybe I need to take this much more seriously than I am. And I did what everybody does. I went and Googled, and it's the scariest ever thing. You just learn so much stuff, not of all which is applicable to you, and everything is doomsday, doomsday, doomsday. So almost immediately I went to see a surgeon, and he wanted to operate straight away. And I took a little bit of caution in thinking about this. I thought, you know, one thing that I know is that you should really, really think twice before you let somebody stick knives into you. It has to be a genuine purpose. And although the doctor, the surgeon, was doing his level best, it didn't work for me at that point in time. So I went back to my GP, and we had a long discussion, and we decided to monitor it a lot closer, and potentially to find another surgeon who might give me different advice, both of which we did. And the other surgeon wasn't as insistent as in doing something immediately. There are a bunch of options. And the one thing that I did learn is that you need to understand what those options are so you can leave it. And I wouldn't advise that. I have a friend whose husband died of prostate cancer, and it's the most painful, most scary thing. So that's not a good option. You have the option of having an operation and potentially radiation and potentially the insertion of also little radium sticks, all of which are designed to kill the cancer. I think it's really important that you might want to have a look at those different options and see which ones suit you best. And also, please talk to people who've been through these processes. There's nothing better than getting firsthand advice or firsthand information that will help you make your own decision. And it's really important for you to be comfortable with your decision, because you are going to, at this stage in your prostate cancer progress, there will come a time that something has to be done. Unless, of course, you're as old as what the doctor thought I was, and that I was going to live with it rather than die from it. So those were the options. And having done my homework and a lot of research, I thought I would try to put off having the surgery as long as possible. So at that point in time, I was going through a period in my life where I was doing a lot of study in metaphysics, and I had studied for 3 years to become a shiatsu practitioner. And I was running.
Alred, may I ask, for anyone who doesn't know what shiatsu is, that you can just explain?
Yes, of course. Thank you. Shiatsu is a Japanese healing therapy based on traditional Chinese medicine. And it is very similar to acupuncture. The theory of the medicine and the pressure points is exactly the same. It's drawn from the same school of thought. But shiatsu is hands-on. Shiatsu means finger pressure. It's a Japanese word for finger pressure. And really, it is an holistic massage which takes into account those same energy lines which run through your body and the same pressure points, and knowing where to use them and how to apply the massage therapy can really help you through many different physical ailments. And I had a deep understanding of traditional Chinese medicine at that time in my shiatsu practice. So I started to apply a lot of those to myself. I had a business partner who we used to meet, and she would perform shiatsu for me, specifically aiming at prostate and the emotions and the issues around that. I also took, I was mindful of having a positive attitude, and that's very difficult. I think having a positive attitude, it's easy for people to say, oh, just be positive. I'm positive it's not that easy. But I think going back to gratitude, if you are grateful for the things that happen in your life, regardless of how dramatic they are, as in this case, prostate cancer, but you're grateful for the lessons that you learn, it helps you get a more positive mindset. And then you do things differently. So I started to look at the food I eat and try to reduce food that would that promotes radicals in your body. I try to eat more food, like cooked tomatoes, for instance. Unfortunately, I love cooked tomatoes that are very specific for prostate cancer that really help, and pomegranate juice. And those small changes to my diet, to my welfare, to my therapies, to my mindset, helped me to live with the thought of potential prostate radical surgery for a much longer time than I would ordinarily have. So it was over 7 years before the surgeon, the doctor, and myself decided that we needed to do something about it, and we scheduled the operation.
Elred, which facts does one have to face when one is getting surgery for prostate cancer?
I think in the time that you build up to the surgery, you start, the doctors are very, very careful to make sure that you understand whatever procedure you're going through, what are the risks, how they intend to mitigate the risks, and what your future holds for you. So I think I know that the most scary part of any radical intrusion for prostate cancer is the fact that you stand a great risk of losing your potential for an erection. So that especially if you're young, you start thinking, well, that's my intimate life, my sex life is going to be ruined, and don't know how I'm going to cope with this mentally, emotionally, physically. They also warn you of possible incontinence, which means that you could spend your life either wearing a little bag or wearing nappies, none of which is a very, very pleasant thought. Nothing, you don't want to put yourself into that position. And they do warn you of the outcomes. If you go for radiation treatment, they warn you that radiation is not specific and it could impact other parts around your prostate, etc. And then they tell you how you have to deal with those things. So it's very, very scary initially, and it's frightening, and I didn't feel that I could go and ask too many friends or relations for support. So you tend to get within yourself, and it makes it far worse if you don't share your emotions, your fears, your concerns. So I recommend that you find somebody, and especially somebody who's been through the process, to talk you through it and essentially metaphorically at least hold your hand. So those were the facts, and they will tell you that they try to mitigate them. The surgeon spoke to me, said we will try to leave the nerves, which will give you some form of at least feeling and potential possibility for less erectile dysfunction, but nothing is guaranteed. So when you go for the procedure, you go in there with a lot of faith in your surgeon and a lot of prayer in your heart.
Yeah, I was wondering how one approaches that operation, because I suppose as it is coming up, it must be very stressful.
It's extremely stressful. And I think that's where courage comes into it, because from somewhere, and this is probably from your core values, you find a way to garner courage. And when you go in for the operation, you need to be calm and I think have faith in what the capabilities of the surgeons and in your capability to live your life after that, whatever the circumstances may be. And I can honestly tell you it's never as bad as your brain thinks it is before the operation.
Can you tell us about your operation?
Yes, of course. I think it's really important. The surgeon I was dealing with said to me before the operation that he only does a few a year and that they are very complex, very difficult, very finicky operations. I think it took about 4 hours. And he said it's not a simple procedure, and especially if you want to preserve nerves, which are, you know, so easily broken or cut or whatever. And he said to me that he preferred to bring along another surgeon who only did prostate surgery. And at no additional cost to myself, this surgeon would actually perform the operation, and the surgeon I was dealing with would support him. Because this second surgeon did prostate operations weekly. So he did several of them in a week. So he was much more practiced, much more skilled, for which I was very, very grateful. It was a long operation. And I made a joke with the anesthetist. As he was telling me to count down, I said to him, "This is great. I'll see you on the other side." And he looked at me in horror and he said, "I hope you don't mean that." And I went, "I'm at the other side of my sleep when I wake up." In any case, when I woke up, I was in ICU for 2 days. I forgot to mention that they gave me, prior to the operation, they gave me an epidural so that I would be pretty much numb from my belly downwards for the operation and post-operative care. And this was because the surgeon said to me that the body heals much, much better when there is no pain. So his whole premise was to keep me pain-free for at least a week post-operative care so that my body could heal in the best possible way. And of course, I'm hugely grateful for that because I know athletes like to say, "No pain, no gain." Mm. I like to say, "No pain. Oh, yay, no pain." And so I was very happy for that. Then I woke up in ICU and having had this epidural, but I was completely, completely paralyzed, for want of a better word. I couldn't even move my toes from my waist downwards. I was not in any pain. But I really started to worry that something had gone wrong and I couldn't move and what was happening to me, and all these thoughts come tumbling in your brain and you're still half anesthetized. And there was a lot going on. Fortunately, the nurses were really, really kind and gentle and considerate, and they came to tell me, "Don't worry, it will go away." And it took about 2 days, by the way. So don't worry if it seemed to take a long time. It took about 2 days for it to completely disappear and I could move and feel and all the rest again. And then after a couple of days in ICU, they moved me to a private ward for 3 days. And you find out that while you've been asleep, they've inserted a catheter, so you now have a bag which collects your urine, and the nurses will change that for you. And apart from giving you a lot of pain tablets, one of those nice little drips that you can press the button. I know it's morphine, and you're not supposed to get hooked on it, but it's really, really good to keep your pain away for that time, and they manage that really carefully. And then they wait 3 days, 4 days, because, as the doctor explained to me, they need to make sure that you have a bowel movement prior to leaving, because that will pretty much give them an idea of this, of the quality, the success of the operation. And they lent me home, but they did let me get up and walk. I was assisted to walk, carrying, you know, you see in the movies, the carrying, pulling along one of these poles with a bag hanging on it. And I was walking along in this typical hospital gown that's open at the back, and the nurse is walking behind me, and she was holding it closed, and she said to me, "Don't worry, I'm covering your ass." There are light moments in this whole process. And eventually I was allowed to go home, and I spent another week in bed at home, still taking a lot of tablets for pain and still hooked up to the bag. And I think then I was allowed to get up and walk around. It was quite a mean operation in that it was fairly physically debilitating, so you didn't really feel like doing too much. And although they kept me pain-free all the time, you've got a bag and you've got a lot of bandages and you've got all sorts of things which come with normally with operations that you have to deal with. But time passes, and I think I went for two more checkups with the surgeon prior to, I think after 3 weeks, they removed the stitches and the catheter. The stitches, by the way, were staples. I think there were 43 staples. I counted them as they came out. Ching, ching,
goodness.
Ching, 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 ching. I don't know if it's because I'm so fat. Maybe somebody thinner would have fewer staples. You know, I don't know. Any case. And then he asked me to be very careful and to make sure that I paid attention to any leakage, because incontinence is a big thing and I need to report it as soon as possible. But he also gave me some advice which I would like to pass on. And I know this sounds a little bit crude and I hope it doesn't upset your podcast. But he said to me that if you want to control your bladder now, because you don't have a prostate to do that for you, you need to use the same muscles that you would to hold a fart in, and you need to strengthen them and you need to work on them prior to the operation, because those are the muscles that are going to help you control your bladder afterwards. And I took him seriously and I worked hard at that. And I'm very pleased to say that I've had not a drop of incontinence since the operation. And I'm convinced it's because of that advice, his capabilities, the good care that I had, all the rest of it. So that was, for me, a hugely positive outcome. And yeah, life is good.
Now, a very important question, Alred. Did you have adequate support, especially emotionally?
No, but that is, I suspect, my own contribution to the operation. Because one of the things that I know that I tend to do is if I have an issue that I need to face in my life, then I clam up, I shut up, and I get my head down and I figure it out in my head and I deal with it the way I need to deal with it, and I'm happy to talk about it afterwards. And so in that time, apart from the GP or the surgeon who do understand these things, giving you some sort of emotional advice, I didn't ask for it. In fact, I actively rejected it, I think. So that's my personality. But looking back, I would absolutely advise anybody who's facing this type of surgery to be a little bit more open about it, to say, this is what I'm facing and these are my fears, and especially to your spouse or your partner, because it's really important to get that emotional support, because that is who's going to support you post-operative care as well. So it's a good idea to engage with those people in your life, your family, your friends, your spouse, before the operation, because then they will understand how to support you after the operation. And I think that's seriously important, and I could have done that a lot better.
Yeah, this is one of the reasons I'm so grateful to be talking to you about this, because men, of course, are men. They are heroes and warriors, and it's very difficult for them to reach out to someone when they are in this situation. And the practical question is, where on earth do you find someone to speak to?
It's very difficult. I think that the more you talk to your friends and your family, the more you'll find that they know somebody who knows somebody who knows somebody. And that extension of your group of friends is really important, because anybody who cares will be doing their best for you, and they will always try to think of a way that they can introduce you to somebody or help you with something. I would stay away from the Googles. There might be, there are possibly support groups that you could find on Google or Facebook or Instagram or wherever, and it's your choice. Perhaps it's a good way to go to find perfect strangers who have been through this process. I guess anybody listening here is pretty much a perfect stranger to me as well. But it's not easy. Find somebody else who's been through the process, because they'll be able to talk to you much better about the emotions and the concerns. And there are very serious concerns. It's pretty much you're facing that part of you which makes you feel like you're a man may disappear. Mm. And that's a great fear.
Yeah. When I think about it, you know, one cannot imagine that one has to deal with that. So I have great respect for people who do, and I absolutely agree that people should ask around till they get someone with, this is pointing to my next question. I was going to say with a positive outlook, and by that I don't mean the positive outlook which ignores everything that's negative. Yes. You know, I mean the courageous outlook.
Yes, I agree with you. You need to get somebody who will tell you the bad stuff, but also how to deal with it. It doesn't help to find somebody who's just going to tell you it's coming up roses and everything's sweet, because it's not.
It's not. How has your experience of cancer influenced your outlook on life?
I think it has made me realize just how damn fine life is, and how short it is, and how it's so easy to just live day by day by day and sort of accept what's coming along. And we all get so busy that we don't take the time out to realize that life is truly a gift, and we need to, I said, take joy minute by minute, day by day. It's so important to understand that we're actually in this life to be happy, to be joyful, to have fun, and notwithstanding all the noise that's going on around us, if you can find that joy within yourself, it's really, really important. And I think that's the perspective that facing prostate cancer brought to me.
And dreams for the future?
Oh, I'm forever dreaming. Yeah. Well, dreams for the future, I try to keep myself fit and healthy and emotionally good and mentally strong, because I am 72 now, and I firmly believe I'm going to live to 100, and that's still a long way away. So I need to be up and about and doing things. So my future is full of travel and lots more cycling and family and visiting my grandkids in England and just having joy with the folk around me, really, truly enjoying life. Once you retire, it's so important to be able to fill your space. Otherwise, it's very, very easy to become a couch potato, and you find life dwindles so fast. So I'm forever dreaming. Every day I have a new dream of a new place to do or something to see or another good food to cook. I'm a foodie. I love cooking. And I enjoy experimenting and seeing how I can impress my friends. So, yeah.
Alred, where can listeners learn more about you or the work you do, as you said, with creating sustainable wealth, or read about your travels?
Oh, thanks for the question. Yes, so to read about my travels, let's start with that one. It's the easiest in the world if you know me. So it's www.cyclefoodfun.com. Cyclefoodfun.com. The three things that bring me great joy. Cyclefoodfun.com. If you want to follow my reels and posts or to see what I'm doing as a wealth engineer, you'll find them on TikTok under my name, Alred Lawrence, or under Peace of Mind. I have two TikTok accounts, and both show the same things. It's just that I like to have two. And you'll find me on Facebook as Alred L, Alred L, and on Instagram as Alred L, E-L-R-E-D-L.
Good. I'm going to include all these links in the podcast notes.
Ah, thank you very much.
Yeah, if someone is listening in the motor car maybe and they'd like to get back to it.
That'll be incredible.
And now I think it's time for your three tips on living a good life.
Ah, thank you. I think I've told you all my three tips already in the basis of this conversation, but let me specify them. Number one, life is short. Find your joy and live it every day. Find your joy, whatever it is that brings you pleasure, passion, whatever it is that makes you excited, makes you want to get up in the morning. My greatest joy every morning is getting up and going to the beach and having a swim. Come rain, shine, hail, whatever the case may be. When I'm swimming in the ocean at Surfers Corner, I'm the happiest I can ever be. So that's my joy. And my joy is to travel. So I work in order to earn money so that I can travel. But I plan and research all the time because even the preparation, even the planning brings me great joy. Sitting and on Google Maps and looking at countries and saying, so where do I go? What's good to be seen? Ah, it brings me great joy. So find something that gives you passion to get up in the morning. Number two, eat good food and drink great coffee if you're a coffee lover. Mm. Drink great tea if you're a tea lover, whatever it is. Eat good food. There's so much junk food out there and so much food that's so easy to buy, but it's not great for you. And good food, you eat with your eyes, with your nose, with your senses, with your palate, with your fingers if you eat a good curry. Eat good food. Drink great coffee. Don't spend money on rubbish when it comes to those things because that also helps you bring you joy, and it tells your body, I'm doing my best I can for you. And I've got a little side note on major. Coffee and wine should not be drunk out of plastic and cardboard. And then my last tip is keep active and busy. And I'm talking, I think it applies to everybody, but I'm talking specifically as a pensioner. I live in a retirement village, and I can see around me people who have retired and basically sat down, and I can see how unfortunately they are degrading year on year off, and I can see those who are keep up and about, who keep busy, who have businesses running, who are out walking, who are out swimming, who are doing things all the time, and they're very different people. They're more energetic and more alive and mentally capable. So keep active and busy. That's my third one for you.
Thank you, Alred. May I ask you a fun question?
You may indeed.
If you were a type of pasta, which type would you be and which sauce would you love to be served with?
Ah, that's a great question. I love to make my own pasta. I was actually thinking about making that as a tip because when I started making pasta, it just didn't seem to work. You get a recipe that'd say 500 grams of Doppio Zero flour and 5 eggs, and it was either too dry or too wet or too sticky or too this or too that. So my tip for pasta makers is weigh everything. So if you're doing 500 grams of flour, use 228 grams of eggs. Weigh it out. Once you've got that right, your pasta is perfect every time. So I think if I was a pasta, I would like to be fettuccine. I think fettuccine
okay.
is nice. It's long, thicker ribbons, and it's delicious. And because I have a great love of spices, I think a nice spicy Diablo sauce with tomatoes and chilies and anchovies and olives would be coat my fettuccine body with great delight.
I'm afraid my mouth is watering at the sound of that. Thank you so much, Alred. I enjoyed speaking to you with your love of life, and thank you for talking about your experience with prostate cancer so openly and honestly.
It was absolutely my pleasure. I've had great joy from doing this with you, Mariette, and it's nice. I've had fun today, and I sincerely hope that something that I've said rings a bell with somebody and perhaps has helped them. And also, Mariette, you are putting out my contact details. If anybody wants to contact me and discuss prostate cancer and my go into it a little bit deeper, they're welcome to. Any one of those, even on my blog, if they leave me a note, I will get the note and I can respond.
Thank you. Thank you for that, Alred. And to our listeners, it was good of you to join us. I would greatly appreciate it if you'd subscribe to this podcast series where you download your podcasts. And if you found this episode valuable, please share it with someone you care about. Go to my website, www.marietsneeman.co.za, for this episode's podcast notes and for free articles and podcast episodes on how to live a happier life and have more fulfilling relationships. To follow me on Facebook, just search for Mariette Sneeman, journalist. Calm, Clear and Helpful is compiled, hosted and edited by me, with original music by Marthe-Marie Sneeman. Catch you next Tuesday at 9:00.